Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, February 21st. We have four bills for public hearing this morning, and we're not going to take the bills in the order that they're printed on the agenda. We will start with 2429. We are likely to go to 2116 next, but that's not assured at this moment. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2429.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2429 expands existing property tax exemption provided for farming equipment, and the bill exempts from property taxation machinery and equipment used to compress and pale harvested straw, hay, grass, or other plants for the purpose of storage or shipment. Specifies that the equipment is tangible personal property and would apply to property tax years after July 1st, 2019.
Thank you. Representative Klein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Klein, and I represent where we're sitting right now, which is kind of the middle of Salem, District 21. And so you might wonder why I'm bringing a bill that has to do with agricultural equipment, but that's partially because I married a farmer's daughter, so I started getting involved in agriculture more directly in 1999, and then I also chair the House Agriculture Committee. And with me is my constituent, Kevin Mannix, who he and I have talked about this issue over the course of probably the last 12 years now, and I have no hair anymore, and now I have to put my stuff out here because I can't read up close anymore. So that's why this is out here, because I'm getting older and long in the tooth. So many pieces of farm equipment, in fact, all should be exempt from property taxes, but there are some assessors who are taxing certain pieces of farm equipment, it turns out. So this bill would correct that. And the Senate actually passed this bill 28-0 last time. It just didn't make it through. But the backstory I just want to talk about is, in my freshman year, we banned field burning in much of the Willamette Valley. And at the time, the issue was there was a lot of smoke hanging in Eugene in particular and cities, and folks really did not think it was good for them and didn't want it anymore. Legislature banned it. What happened to the farmers next? That's what I was also worried about, of course, because I was chairing House Ag that next session. We tried to develop different ways for them to deal with the residue that used to be burned off. We tried to find different ways, and we even funded a big project in Lane County to see if we could turn it into cellulosic ethanol to make a market out of it. Didn't turn out to be commercially viable. But we found something in that industry, which is they compress it and then they send it overseas, and they use this equipment to do it. So part of our compromise, I think, is yes, we're gonna take away burning, but we're also gonna do some things to try and help you figure out what you're gonna do with the stubble and straw. And the problem is there are some assessors who say that's not really farm equipment and we're gonna tax it, whereas all the other farm equipment is not taxed and is exempt. But in this case, we have a problem where a few counties are taxing this. And I may have gotten some technical detail wrong, and Kevin, the Department of Revenue, can tell you, but there's also a amendment that would be needed with Department of Revenue that Kevin can talk about, where we use the term tangible personal property, and I think the term should be real property, but I've never been on revenue, and I don't even know what the difference exactly is for that, but some smart people out in the hall just told me that, and so we should change that.
Thank you, Mr. Mannix.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in private practice in Salem, generally engaging in business law. I did, for 10 years, represent what is mostly Representative Klem's current district in the House of Representatives, and neither of us had farms in our district, but we certainly got to know farmers as we have done our work. I don't have a family member who's a farmer, but I happen to have engaged in farmers on business issues. This issue truly does grow out of our effort to eliminate field burning, and it is somewhat special because I was involved in the earlier dialogue on field burning, and the discussion was, all right, how do we help these farmers do something about the stubble and hay, because it's not really commercially viable within the United States. And they developed a foreign market for this, generally as forage, in Japan and South Korea. And in order to export it most cost effectively, they found because you export based on containers and the volume of the container, not the weight of the container, that the more they could compress the hay, the more efficient they could be in shipping it abroad to at least be able to make some profit out of removing this material from Oregon instead of burning it and filling the air with smoke. And in the process, they've gotten more and more efficient. Some of the early equipment was out there in the fields. It was on the back of a trailer, and it was seen as farm machinery and equipment. But over time, they've developed much more sophisticated equipment that works better. But in the Willamette Valley, they also put it inside the barn to get it out of the rain, because wet hay is not nearly as good as dry hay, because you will have fungus and rot potential. So it's now inside the barn. And then since it's inside the barn, they plug it in inside the barn. And if it vibrates too much, they might even bolt it down. And over time now, some county assessors have said, that's not farm machinery and equipment. It's now part of the real property, and we're going to tax it. Some counties don't. Some counties do. And we had this discussion back in 2017. Senate Revenue heard the matter. The Senate, by a unanimous vote, passed what is the mirror image of this bill and sent it over to the House. This is an opportunity to restart the process. And the key element that's unusual here, I think, is that we are not trying to define what is real or personal property. Representative Clem alluded to this. Our Department of Revenue has been very astute about trying to make sure real property is one thing and personal property is another. And there is a phrase in here, I think, that could be removed so that we are not defining this property. We're just saying it's exempt. If it's hay compression and baling equipment, it's exempt. And the Department of Revenue has quite properly said, well, this part of the statutes does say whether it is real or whether it is personal, these are exempt. And there's a phrase on line 28, on page one of the bill, that says tangible personal property, that is. That phrase can be removed, so we're not messing up the Department of Revenue's definition system. And we respect that, and we've talked to Revenue about it, and that is one amendment that could be clarifying here that lets Revenue breathe a sigh of relief, and we hope makes it a good bill for passage when you have an opportunity for a work session. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all the testimony from this panel. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Reschke.
Representative Clem, thanks for bringing this forward again. And I saw you on TV earlier this morning testifying somewhere else. You're making the circuit this morning. Is that right?
Yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't have to be in here before 10 a.m., but here I am. It's great.
Very good. Are you looking for sponsors and chief co-sponsors?
Let's see. Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, I absolutely am. I had to make sure it wasn't a committee bill. Yeah. Sometimes I do House Ag Committee bills, and then nobody can sign on. But yes, I am. This is a personal bill. I would love to have supporters.
All right.
Of any caliber, co-chief, Reschke's, whatever caliber you want
Very
to put
good.
Yourself in.
All right, thank you.
I have one. How many farmers do we have using this equipment?
Madam Chair?
Hundreds, thousands, just a guess.
Around the state, I'd say several dozen. That's mm-hmm. about right.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, and then some counties don't, we don't have the interpretation debate, so then you narrow down to the ones in the counties, so not very many.
Okay.
That's a lot of taxes for that one farmer, obviously, on something that is pretty clearly not for fun. It's meant to use to compress farm materials and send it overseas.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I think you probably have more than you think, because there's growers in Eastern Oregon compress hay and put it and ship it to the Pacific Rim countries. So it's not just the straw and chaff that you do it, but they do hay and make it into, and you indicated that it will accept hay as part of this definition. So how many counties do that or take this interpretation that it is not exempt properties?
Madam Chair, may I answer? Madam Chair, Representative Finley, I'll put it this way. As I've made inquiries, the answers I've gotten from county assessors have varied. 2 years ago, the Lane County assessor said, well, we have one that we know of, but we have others that we don't know of. what does that mean? Well, they haven't gone out to try to find them. And in another county, there's a half dozen where that county is saying, well, we're going to start trying to impose a tax. By and large, I'd say there's three or four counties out of 36 that pretty clearly have decided to be aggressive about going after this equipment. Most of the other counties, to my reckoning, have not done so.
And you know where the Association of County Assessors stands on this?
Madam Chair, Representative Finley, 2 years ago when this bill came up in the Senate, there were some assessors who testified, and the stand that I understood at the time, and I've not seen new information, was all we want is clarification. What do we do with this?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Do we have a representative from the assessors here today? Will they be speaking?
No.
Okay. Question then. Isn't the issue that the equipment is actually bolted down or affixed in some way to the building? Is that the transitional point for decision making for the assessors?
Madam Chair, Representative Morris, that is correct. That has become the issue because they say once it's bolted down, we have to treat it as real property. Even though some of that equipment still is out there on trailers and fields doing the same thing, and it's personal property. Right. So, and that is part of the issue.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Marsh, again, I shouldn't try and play Revenue Committee member, but I'm reading the current law, and even there it says a real property building structure improvement is exempt from ad valorem property taxation if it is used primarily to grow plants for agricultural or horticultural production. So if the building is like a greenhouse, it would be. Even the building would be. So then why would we take something that used to be out in the field, we put it inside of a building, bolt it down so it doesn't rattle too much, and then start taxing it when we otherwise wouldn't? That's the policy side. We generally try to not tax farm-related stuff so they can afford to keep growing food to feed us or straw to feed other animals.
And I'm going to ask one final question before I call the next panel. The equipment, after it's bolted down, is it ever unbolted and taken out into the field?
Madam Chair, I've asked that question. Most of that equipment can be unbolted and moved. Generally, it is not. Once it's in place, it's just left there. But it is capable of being unbolted and moved to another location.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'll call the next panel now.
Thank you.
Wendy Johnson, Jody Weiser, and Marcia Kelly.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. We had two questions, concerns with this bill, and since everyone's talking about their farm heritage, I just wanted to let you know, since I've never done that on the record, that I'm an Iowa farm girl who transplanted to Oregon. grew up doing the hay baling and such myself. As has been already stated, Section 1 of the bill has real property and equipment and personal property and then real property, and then now there's this new one that calls this equipment something else, calls it machinery equipment, then calls it tangible. So we are concerned about that because there's a lot of case law and we don't want to undo that. This bill was up last year and we had concerns with it because my understanding was this isn't always used just by a farmer for their personal use, that this is a business sometimes. And so we just want to make sure that we're treating businesses similarly. So I don't even know if sometimes this equipment, I've heard it's very expensive equipment and that it could be a business in and of itself. And if that doesn't look like farm equipment, like the rest of the exemptions. And I think we just need to treat businesses that how they, just similarly. I haven't seen the revenue impact on this and whether it would even be in, this equipment would be in a city or not. But it's just a concern that the league's position is on any exemption that affects our revenue base, that we need to make sure that we're very careful on that return on investment is correct for the community. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. If we were to think of the Oregon tax code as a piece of fine fabric, we would notice that it's become more moth-eaten than whole, year by year losing any rationale for treatment of property, income, or transactions. ORS 307.397 exempts from property taxes certain types of farm property used for farming operations. The statute that allows this expenditure does not explicitly state a purpose, nor does this bill. Presumably, the tax expenditure report says the purpose is to improve the financial viability of farming and ease tax administration. Well, clearly, the testimony has shown us that it's not this equipment is not easing tax administration. We need a definition one way or another. And since farmers are already deploying this equipment, it's clearly financially feasible. And so we would just be increasing the profitability for the farmers or decreasing the prices for people in other countries, not in the state of Oregon, for the use of this compressed straw. House Bill 2429 would add a new category of equipment, hay balers, to our exemptions. Since the text of the bill offers no purpose, we need to, that would need to be added so that it could be evaluated in the future. We understand that exempting all property, income, and transactions from state tax would allow Oregonians to keep more of their money. Farmers would have no difficulty acquiring hay balers, but on the other hand, state and local government would cease to exist. If legislators get in the habit of explaining why they are compelled to propose exempting discrete property, income, or transactions from taxation, we're compelled to oppose their proposals.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I'm Marsha Kelly with the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and I've been following the Revenue Committee since 2001, and every year there's yet another tax credit. And all of those tax credits, in this case for hay balers, which would be a property tax, starts affecting the way that we can educate our kids, take care of other people who need care, and keep our seniors in their homes. If I was a farmer in a farming family, I would not be paying, or the family would not be paying, $34,000 of property taxes on income property in Marion County. One of the proponents of the bill on testimony gave address. You can look up address. They're paying on 303 acres, $10,000, and that's not on the acreage. It's actually on some of their personal property. There seems to be a disconnect. Do we have to continue giving tax credits to people to stay in business when they obviously can stay in business without the tax credit because they already have the equipment? We need to pay for government. And part of paying for government is paying taxes, because otherwise we have no government.
Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the League. Where was the League position on exempting other farm properties on the current exemptions?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Hernandez, the general farm exemptions have been in the books for, I would say, decades. And so that's been a public policy position, but the League's position on new exemptions is that and I think it's been the legislative prerogative as well to really focus on what is the purpose and make sure that, I mean, that's what actually the most frustrating part to a local government is. By one bill, you can exempt property and affect the tax base of your local governments. It's not a choice of the local governments. And so when that's done, the League's position is to analyze those exemptions carefully. But on the past exemptions for farm equipment. To my knowledge, the league has been supportive of the industry. Our question just simply is this really about farmers, or is this another industry? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I recall previous testimony that these were hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of equipment here that doesn't look like your normal farm equipment, but I don't know.
Follow up.
Yes.
So if they can't burn the hay, because I imagine we passed a law to, or we said you couldn't burn this hay, and now they have to react to us. I'm trying to understand why we wouldn't consider that. If they have to react to a law that we did, and then they have to buy to get rid of it, why that isn't annexed under farmland? That's just me commenting. But my question, if the goal that was mentioned from the previous speakers is to include this under the definition of farmland or equipment, it's because it's not included in the exceptions, or at least the assessors aren't. I'm having trouble, on the one hand, distinguishing why it shouldn't be under that exemption, and then on the other hand, if you don't really have a, if you want clarity, I guess, and the goal is pretty clear, could we get an amendment that clarifies exactly to that point, so that, you know, if you're not stating a value statement, you're just wanting to make sure the technicalities of the bill are right to what they're intending to do. Perhaps helping draft that language would be helpful.
Attorney Representative Hernandez, I would just respond that the analogy is like, take potatoes, and now you're going to process those potatoes. We give the farmer the exemptions for the potatoes, but we don't give exemptions for the truck or the plastic bags, you know, to put the potato chips in. The question is, is this the right spot in the chain of this property? And I don't have the answer to that. I just think it needs to be looked at carefully. But if you were going to make an amendment, it would be, you know, you're not going to give this an exemption to a business that this is their, you know, their job to do is compressing. If it was to do farming, and that's a part of their farm, maybe that's a distinction. I don't know how tricky that is to write that definition. I'm just suggesting that we need to be very careful when we write broad sweeping definitions and new exemptions.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the comments of the city. I think you're accurately weighing this. I would share with folks who aren't sure how this all plays out to go Google it and look. The representative and Mr. Mannix, I thought, did a very, very good job in laying out the argument. It's one thing to go out and have a combine that goes out and harvests, and then they go through and they cut, and it hits the ground. Now you've got to do something with it. And so they bring it all together. And then the question is what's the most effective way to store harvested straw, hay, grass, or other plants? And so what they do, in the interest of utilizing space effectively, they compress it. They press it together, and they take a big bale, that may weigh 80 pounds, and they compress it down to a 2-foot little block. It's the same harvested straw, hay, grass, or other plants, but it's now compressed. And what it does is it allows for more effective storage. Now, that's the farmer side. On the other side, you raise a good question, because there are companies out there that then take that and utilize it for profit-making activity. And so I would encourage this committee to go Google search it, watch it, and it'll bring greater clarity as to where in that chain we are. I personally support the initiative, but that shouldn't be a surprise coming from rural Eastern Oregon. So, thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you. Before I close the public hearing on this bill, I understand that the Marion County Assessor and Department of Revenue are in the room and may have some comments for us to clarify or answer questions that have come up. If you would like to speak, come forward.
Chair and members of the committee, so this is a little bit of a complicated issue, and I think I'll hopefully be able to bring a little bit of clarity. There are a couple things at play here. First of all, there's a question as to whether property is what we call real property or personal property. So real property is generally things that are so big that they can't be moved. You think about buildings, things that are attached to the buildings. Personal property is generally smaller movable property. We have had this, it's administratively efficient for the assessors to put property into different accounts. It's important for purposes of valuation. Personal property generally depreciates faster than real property. So it's really meaningful which of the accounts this goes into. We have Supreme Court rulings on this issue. 7-Up bottling is kind of the key case, and it basically says if you're hardwired, hard plumbed, bolted down, so big as to not be movable, those types of things, that's considered real property as opposed to personal property. Now, farm exemptions. The exemption for farm personal property is very broad, right? It's 307.394. It's machinery and equipment used primarily in the preparation of land, planting, raising, cultivating, irrigating, harvesting, or placing into storage farm crops. There's dispensation for feeding, breeding, management of animals. Animal husbandry and other items that are in there. So it's a very broad for personal property. Now, sometimes we've had some questions as to whether property is actually being used for farming or whether it's used for processing, and that line can be a little blurry. We've had some work from the court on that. Generally, processing equipment is not exempt. We have the King Estates Winery decision from the Supreme Court that talks about when you take a crop and you turn it into a product. And so that line can be a little confusing for folks sometime. But in the case of this equipment, I think that really what we're talking about is whether or not it's real or personal property. The former panel correctly pointed that there are certain items of real property that are also exempted that are agricultural related, but that's a much more narrow exemption than the exemption for personal property. You can easily add this hay baling compression equipment. The Department of Revenue is completely neutral on the policy of whether you want to exempt this equipment. You can certainly add this into the real property exemption, but it's our position that the assessors who are out there who are taxing this property currently as real property, when it is such, I mean, there is some hay bale compression that's on wheels. That's personal property. And unless the assessor takes the position that they're somehow processing, then that equipment would be exempt. But for this big property, I mean, these look like factories, basically. It's a big equipment shed. It's got lines of equipment. I have Googled it myself to Rep. Smith's point. And if you look at it, this is big stuff. It's not something that you can just pick up and move around. It's not a farm implement. So, and it's not sometimes not owned by a farmer, technically. It's owned by an outfit that does this compression work for farmers. So the farmers bring in the bigger bales and they compress it down and get it ready for storage for them. So a lot of issues there. We do think that the assessors who are taxing it as real property are doing the right thing. If there are assessors who are not taxing real property that's used for this hay bale compression, they need to get in line. They're not, you know, this should be taxable. And so that's basically where we're at. I hope that gives some clarity.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm Tom Rolfing, the Marion County Assessor. I'm also co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I just happened to be in the room today when you were asking if there was an assessor available to talk about this. So regarding Osaka's legislative goals, I guess, We look at the statutes as, you know, at, or at the bills as to whether or not we can administer them. We are primarily administrators of the policy that is passed by the legislature. With that respect, we don't have any administrative concerns that are not being currently addressed by the Department of Revenue and the proponents of the bill. So,
thank you. Thank you for being here and making the statement. Questions, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. So the same piece of equipment, this is for either one of you that want to respond. If you go to the farm and it's in a field, is it personal? And if it's in the barn, bolted down, it's real? I mean, is that, it can we make those kind of distinctions on the same piece of machinery, depending on where it sits on the, in the farm?
Well, if it's bolted down and hardwired, it's considered real property.
Senator Representative Marsh, that's correct. And I don't know how often the situation that you're talking about exactly comes about. The, you know, the hay bale compression equipment that's out in the field, it's on like a trailer, it's on wheels. It's meant to be, you know, towed around and to be movable. And it looks different than the larger lines of equipment that you might find in like a building that's dedicated to this same activity. So the equipment does the same purpose, but there it's different looking equipment. And but to your point, yeah, it does make a difference as to whether it's, you know, I mean, and I know it's a weird line, but I mean, you have a lamp that you plug in versus a light fixture that's hardwired. That makes a difference as to whether it's real or personal property.
And then my second question is whether either one of you have any idea of impact. How much money are we talking about? How broadly is this machinery available? And then the corollary to that question is the one raised by the league, which is this equipment, do we know if this is equipment is used in settings other than farm settings?
Rep. Nathanson, or I'm sorry, Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, I would obviously defer to Legislative Revenue Office on what the revenue impact of this would be, and I don't know if they've done that work yet, but some of this equipment, as was testified, it's large and it's expensive equipment. And then your second question was whether it's located in farm settings. You know, I don't know whether it's in city limits or not, but I do believe that some of this equipment is housed in basically what machine sheds that are kind of a standalone operation. So it's like kind of like a ag industrial kind of setting. And it's, I think they're near the farms, but I don't think that all of this equipment is necessarily located on a farm. Because my understanding is that some folks do this operation for multiple farmers.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in a potato packing facility, there's lots of conveyor belts, lots of machines. Is that real property or is that farm equipment? Is it exempt like farm equipment?
Sure. Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, in a packing facility.
It's not in the field, it's in a building. And it's got lots of conveyors. They put the potatoes on. They go all over the building, getting sorted, washed, packed for market. I'm just wondering if that currently is taxed as real property. If you don't know, you can get it to me later. But I'm just curious how that's machinery that's all bolted down and moving parts and so forth. And I'm just trying to get my hands around whether that's taxed, how that's taxed.
So there's a dispensation for a property that's used for placing farm crops into storage. But what you're describing sounds like it may go a little bit beyond that. The Department of Revenue has an administrative rule that says that processing is altering the crop in any way, such as washing, icing, sorting, grading, waxing, boxing, slicing, or cutting. So that's where we have drawn the line through our administrative rule on what becomes processing equipment.
Okay.
Brushing dirt off of something is not the same as washing it, though.
Yeah.
So, and there are some packing operations that are located like on an edge of a field where there have been tax court decisions about what pieces of equipment there are technically processing versus placing into storage. So
okay.
It's an issue that's been litigated a bit, and and the finer points, I'm maybe not 100% on.
Okay.
Representative Smith?
Just very quickly, Chair. Over and over again, I see agencies representing issues that they're not quite sure on, which is fair. I mean, if they don't have that education or background, et cetera. To me, it would seem prudent on an issue, especially such as this, we bring the Department of Ag chair in and ask her opinion. She's the expert, not the Department of Revenue. Just a thought.
Thank you. That won't be this morning. But I don't anticipate standing at ease while we find this
right.
person and
right.
drag her over. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you. There's no one else signed up to testify on this subject. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2429. I intend to open a public hearing on House Bill 2116 in just a moment. I want to let you know that 2168 and 2684 will be heard after that, assuming there is time remaining. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2116.
Oh, I shouldn't say that. I don't know.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2116 the bill is going to require Department of Revenue to establish an automated method for certifying tax compliance via an internet website that's fully accessible to the public no later than January 1st, 2020. And the reason for that is the measure also is requiring state agencies, boards, and commissions that issue occupational or professional licenses within Oregon to require licensees, so the individuals or businesses that are applying for those licenses, as a condition for receiving the license or renewing that license, to demonstrate that they're in compliance with specified tax programs, such as the personal income tax, cigarette, other tobacco taxes. The measure does specify conditions that the individual or the corporation must meet to be considered in compliance, so it defines what that term of compliance means. And it does incrementally implement these license requirements, beginning with January 2nd, 2020, and then by January 2nd, 2024, it would be fully phased in. So it begins with some of the different sized license boards and commissions, and then eventually we'll grab all of them over the four-year period. And it does require Department of Revenue to implement a communication plan of these changes no later than January 1st, 2020 as well, to notify the boards, the commissions, and individuals that are likely to be subject to these compliance requirements to get their license.
Thank you. First up to testify, I'd like to hear from ODOT and Department of Administrative Services.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Amy Joyce from the Oregon Department of Transportation. I think I'll preface my remarks by saying I'm coming to you in the true spirit of a public hearing, intending to perhaps learn more than perhaps I provide information. And if I can incorporate by reference Representative Smith's comments on the earlier bill, that sometimes we don't know everything when we come forward to testify on a bill, and that's the position I find myself in. But basically, under the provisions of the bill, HB 2116 would require people who come to the department for the various licensures and certifications that we issue and provide tax information. I'm struggling a bit to know which of the things that we issue in our very diverse department might be captured under this. So, for example, our DMV division issues commercial driver licenses and commercial learner permits. We think that probably falls under this, the rubric of HB 2116. So that's about 83,000 individuals in Oregon who have a CDL. But with the commercial learner's permit that we also are required to issue by federal law, you're talking about perhaps 30,000 issuance of biennium where we'd be covered there. Then we have some more rather obscure programs within DMV. We do certificates for vehicle dealers, for dismantlers, for vehicle appraisers. We issue certificates for RV dealers to have weekend shows, all kinds of things like that. In our motor carrier division, which is our heavy truck regulation division, pardon me, we have the situation where carriers are required to register with motor carrier to be able to operate in the state of Oregon. That includes Oregon-based carriers, but it also includes all the out-of-state carriers that travel through the state. So then we get into issues of interstate commerce. Can we legally require those out-of-state motor carriers, which would number in the hundreds of thousands per year that operate on Oregon highways, can we require them to perform this action of proving that they're up to date with Oregon tax law? And if we can't, then are we in the situation where we require Oregon-based carriers to perform this exercise, but not impose this on the out-of-state carriers, the competitors to our Oregon-based carriers. So again, I don't necessarily have answers to those right now, but I think here again, in the true spirit of a public hearing, to learn more about what types of professional or occupational certifications requirements are captured or are intended to be captured under this idea, and which are not. And I'm very happy to take any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Adam Crawford, and I'm here today representing DAS. And I very much would like to associate myself with Ms. Joyce's comments about trying to seek greater clarity around this. It's a little bit odd for me as DAS to be in here today. We don't do any licensure or certification of a type mentioned in the bill. However, I come to you kind of with the hat on of where we fit in, as we keep very close eye on bills of statewide impact, bills that otherwise would impact the entire enterprise of state government. I have had several questions and comments and concerns from various health and licensing boards, professional certification boards, trying to seek greater clarity around this bill. If it's the committee's intention to continue to work this bill, we would love to be involved in those conversations so that clarity could then be moved out to the rest of state government. And with that, in the interest of time, happy to take any questions.
Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. I've read this, and this is just the Marine Board issues a license to operate a motorboat. This looks like that would apply. You'd have to have your taxes current before you get a license to operate your boat. The 100,000 CDL licenses that you operate to drive a truck. I mean, this is an incredible overreach that I appreciate your comments. I guess I don't have a question for you. I think, holy smoke, this is a huge deal. The tentacles go out, and I think you understated the impacts to all the licenses and then the certificates. This is a big deal. I think it's unfortunate.
Representative Gresham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And mine's more of a comment, and you're going to hear this from me. You've already heard it from me once, and you'll hear from me again. This is a committee bill. There's no legislator tied to this. We have no legislator coming up and saying this is my bill. We have two agencies coming forward saying this is what we think might happen. So I have nowhere to go with this. Who do I talk to learn what the intent of this bill is?
I will, I guess, pose a response.
Sure.
Since Department of Revenue is in the room, if they wouldn't mind, I'd like them to come forward and suggest what they believe the likely intent of the bill was. I'm assuming it has something to do generally with if you're going to have a business in Oregon, there should be some demonstration of tax compliance.
That's not how it reads.
Yeah, that's a little different than the breadth of this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And yes, this is a bill, I believe, in 2009 and 2010, this body passed a bill, House Bill 3082, that required us to do a pilot project on license compliance. And we did phase one and phase two and reported back to this committee, I believe, as late as 2014. We did it with, I think, six different boards. I have the Mortuary Board, Board of Tax Practitioners, and the Construction Contractors Board initially. They were all occupational licenses. They are not intended to be like your boater's license. That's just for recreation. And I believe that is in 2116. The second phase included the Architect Examiners Board, the Plumbing Board through DCBS, and the Department of Agriculture. We reported back to this committee and the then chair, Representative Barnhart, about the progress of that pilot project, and it did improve compliance marginally. We did not have an automated way of dealing with it at the time. Our new system does have the capacity to do that. It is not yet programmed to do so, but there is a big manual component to looking at these compliance checks to make sure. Sometimes they can automatically be checked and shown as in compliance, but if they, for whatever reason, trigger out because maybe there's a payroll account that doesn't look quite right, that requires someone to look at it manually. So there's not a fully automated way to ever get to a compliance check. So that is in the, I think, in the history of this bill. In 2014, I think we reported back to the committee that we would want to wait until we were done implementing our new system and revisit this. I think this bill is an effort from the former chair to continue that conversation, and probably why it's a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to give context to folks who weren't around in 2009, your little sister committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means General Government that oversees revenue, was responsible for collection of dollars. And as was just shared, if you'll recall when this was introduced, it was 2009. What was going on in 2009? State revenues were in a significant decline. And so one of the things your Ways and Means Revenue General Government overseeing revenue was looking at is how did they enhance collection efforts. And so I do want to give one last piece of perspective is our poor Department of Revenue gets beat up no matter which way they turn. Because on the one hand, we hit them on the head and say, why aren't you collecting from these people who won't pay? And then we hit them over the head and say, but why are you doing it this way?
Yeah.
And so they really are caught between a rock and a hard place.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'll just reiterate three agencies who think or believe but don't know because they can't know. And law doesn't operate that way. Law is or isn't. It's a heavy mallet. And so it's hard for me to understand what the intent is without a legislator's name attached to this or a legislator to come testify on the record why this is being put forth. And they can't do that. They can give us clarity of what has been in law. They can say how it will affect their agency, but they can't take an opinion or tell us why this is being brought forward before this committee.
Thank you. I would like the Department of Revenue to provide this committee through LRO, provide us with a copy of whatever materials you had available at the time on the pilot project, because it does seem like this was intended to be a continuation of a conversation that was the result of an earlier effort. So I'd like us to have that mm-hmm. material available mm-hmm. to us as part of the record. Thank you. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for being here and testifying. And I just want to respond a little bit to Representative Reschke. Just to be clear, in the whole, I think the intent is, this wasn't my bill, but the intent is we talk a lot in here about how do we improve compliance, how do we collect on debt. It's a regular conversation here, and this sounds like a clunky effort to do that. The idea is, if we're licensing somebody to do a practice, shouldn't we make sure they're paying their taxes? From that, it goes out through policy and recommendations, and you realize how incredibly challenging that is. So I just wanted to put a small, the intent, I think, is good. I think we all share the idea that people should pay their taxes, people should be in compliance, and people should pay their debts. And yet when it is an example of sometimes when we try to do that legislatively, and the value, I got to say, of our voluntary compliance system in general, because as we discover when we try to figure out how to make it mandatory, it is really, really challenging to do so. So I just wanted to say that for the record, that there is good intent in this. The idea is, how do we increase compliance? What do we do when we talk about people getting contracts with the state and then they haven't paid their taxes? That's the kind of stuff we want to avoid. The intent is good. It's unfortunate that it seems like it's just challenging to implement.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel?
Thank you.
And now I'd like to hear from Dan Torres.
Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, members of the committee. My name is Dan Torres, and I'm a political coordinator with Oregon AFSCME, representing 27,000 workers across the state, including a number of licensed fields, from nursing to doctors to child care providers. Oregon AFSCME has been an advocate for revenue and transparency many times in the past. We also fundamentally believe that everyone should pay their fair share. For those reasons, we are intrigued by the intent and the proposal of this bill. Unfortunately, we have some logistical questions about how this would roll out. We have some concerns about adequate safeguards to make sure we aren't hurting working families and giving individuals plenty of chance and opportunity to come into compliance without hurting their ability to make a living. We also recognize that some scenarios exist where an individual's tax compliance situation may be out of their control or immediate remedy due to joint filing situation or other circumstances. For someone with an accountant or a CPA, tax issues may be routine to solve should an issue arise, but that won't be the case for everyone who may have a tax compliance issue. We look forward to continuing this discussion, especially around sideboards or safeguards, to make sure that we mitigate the impact on working families. Because keeping in mind that licensure is not just doctors, it's not just people who own businesses, it's also mental health therapists, it's child care workers, it's people working day to day. So we are intrigued by the proposal. We like the conversation where it's going, but want to talk about the actual rollout and implementation of it should it move forward. So thank you very much for your time, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you. No one else has signed up to testify on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on 2116, and I'm now both bills. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2168 and House Bill 2684.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2168 is a committee bill, and House Bill 2684, can we do them together?
Yes.
Is a bill sponsored by Representative Nose. They're identical bills that would repeal what is currently known as the gigabit property tax exemption. And the language is such that it would repeal the property tax exemption on a company that builds out infrastructure for gigabit communication networks. And that would apply to property tax years after July 1st, 2019.
Thank you. I would like to hear first from League of Oregon Cities and Department of Revenue.
Any
first. May I go first?
Go for it.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. So before you today are two bills that are identical. As far as I can tell, they both would do the same thing. They repeal the gigabit exemption and effective starting for the July 1, 2019 tax year. So just a little bit of perspective here. What we're really talking about is central assessment. Central assessment is a little different than the way that most properties in Oregon are taxed. Central assessment looks at the unit value of the property, so we look at the value of the company as a whole, and then we allocate that value to Oregon and apportion it out to the districts. The biggest difference with central assessment is that you're taxed on your intangible property. That includes things like your goodwill, brand, intellectual property, that sort of thing. So Department of Revenue began centrally assessing communication companies in 2009. And we've been in tax court and the Supreme Court on the issue ever since. we won a Supreme Court decision in October of 2014 that determined that that these companies, that was the Comcast decision, determined that Comcast was actually a communication company and set some standards around what communication was. So it made it clear that they were subject to central assessment. They then appealed on what the taxable value of their property was. The question was whether or not when we brought them onto the central assessment roll, when we picked up that intangible property, is that an event that triggers a MAV exception, a maximum assessed value exception, so we can increase their value more than the normal 3% increase that one would see. I'm happy to say that the Supreme Court has ruled in Dish just this year, January of 2019, that the Department of Revenue's position was correct, and that we did get to add that value for tax purposes. In the meantime, we had a settlement on the Comcast case that was in June of 2018. We settled at $155 million plus. I think it was a very favorable settlement for the state of Oregon. And as a part of that settlement, Comcast agreed that they would not pursue the gigabit exemption. So in 2015, the legislature passed Senate Bill 611. It put some sideboards on how it is that we tax intangibles as they relate to communication companies. There was some special dispensation for data centers that made it less likely that that property would be subject to having the intangible property taxed. That was to encourage the development of data centers in Eastern Oregon in particular. There was a cap put on what amount of intangibles we will tax for all centrally assessed companies. It is 100, you are taxed on no more than 130% of the historic or original cost of your tangible property. It added, we already had an exemption for FCC licenses, and it added an exemption for franchises and satellites. And then the last thing that Senate Bill 611 did was this gigabit exemption. The gigabit exemption has been widely stated as was put in place for Google. We were trying to draw Google into the Portland market. They were doing fiber at that time. The way that the exemption works is it basically, if you build a qualified project, it basically exempts all of your intangible property. So you would only be taxed on your tangible property, more like, you know, your house is treated in the tax system. We had three companies apply to the PUC, Comcast, Frontier, and Google. Again, Google never built their project. Comcast agreed to forego the gigabit exemption as a part of the settlement that we reached last year. And so currently the only company that's receiving the exemption is Frontier. So the Department of Revenue, again, we try and stay very neutral on the policy issues that you folks have to deal with, whether a certain type of property or piece of property should be exempted or not. You know, that really is something that is more in your area, but we do bring administrative concerns to you. And we certainly have some concerns about this gigabit exemption. There's a lot of confusion about whose duties are what. So the PUC has a role. They initially approve the projects. And then the Department of Revenue, we feel like we have a role as well. The PUC will often approve projects that have not been constructed. And the Department of Revenue then comes in and says, has this project been built, maintained, and operated as is required by the statute? Companies have disagreed. As soon as the gigabit exemption rolled out, we were in litigation on the issue. Again, currently not in litigation, but we did not get the clarity from the court on you know, whose role is what. There's been some confusion, I think, about what the legislative intent was on the bill. We've had a lot of members in this committee testify that, you know, we didn't make this so that it could just sit on a shelf, or, you know, what is it? What's an offer? What's a bona fide offer? I don't think that people picture the service as being as expensive as it ended up being. It's about $300 a month for most of the service. So there has been some real concerns expressed in the committee. I will let you know that we've heard that different companies are thinking about applying for the gigabit exemption. At least one company that does, is an internet provider, we know may apply. And then also down the road, we're concerned about 5G wireless, whether or not those folks will come in and apply. That service can be, says the next tier of service for cell phones, can be extremely fast. So this could have a revenue impact that could really balloon out in the future if those folks begin to apply. Again, we try and stay neutral on the policy issues, but it is our responsibility to let you know the information to make the policy decisions. I'll just say, you know, Google's not coming. They've given up on their fiber. So that if that was part of the policy, it's not going to be met. We hear that both Comcast and Frontier have had very few customers for this service. I don't know how many customers at this time, but, you know, we had testimony in this committee February 5th, 2018, and the representative at that time, Kathy Dahlquist, just testified that most folks simply don't need the speed of internet service to do what it is that they want to do around their house. We think that there are probably other ways that you guys could look at facilitating internet service. So I'll close with, what's the impact if this thing is actually repealed? So the permanent exemption is how it's written right now. As long as you continue to operate the qualified project, you get the exemption in perpetuity. It would become a single year exemption. That would prevent future applicants, and so we would kind of cut it off where it is right now. There was a lot of conversation in 18. Frontier came in, and we had a conversation about how they had made a good faith effort to put some money in to qualify for this project, and it wouldn't be fair at that time to take it away. And what they had said was that in that February 5th testimony was that they wanted to be made whole on their investment, which at that time was reported to be $2.6 million. The PUC has just issued a report that the legislature required on the gigabit project, just came out this month. And in that report, it indicates that in 2017, Frontier spent $1,157,000 on property, newly constructed or installed property to qualify for the exemption. And then the report also states that the amount of the exemption that they received for the 2018-19 tax year was $2.57 million. So again, they had testified previously that they had put in $2.6 million. So in any case, I think that, you know, the amount of money that they would receive off a one-year exemption would be enough to make them whole on the investment that they took to initially qualify for the exemption. They may have had some investment since that time, but and that'll be a policy question for you, is whether you want to, you know, continue to put money into this. But I'm not aware of any other tax exemption where you get 100% of the money that you invest covered. Generally, we do tax exemptions in order to facilitate the company putting some money in and doing an investment. So so that's what I have for you today on this gigabit exemption.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Mark has gone into the great detail. I'll just put a little color on where we sat. This bill came about in 2015 because of the court decision in 2014 that really did increase the taxes on cable companies, because the court finding that, yes, the cable company is a communication company means your taxes are going to go up. So the response was, okay, let's give everybody a deal to lower it to be reasonable with the various types of services. So the bill in 2015 was known as Senate Bill 611, and I literally started the league the month that bill dropped, and that was my reward. It's been my nightmare since then. But Mark went over that it had lots of parts. There was a really important data center question happening in Central Oregon on which companies were coming, and so we had to clarify, and that was not a new an exemption, but it was a clarification to deal with that. But then we piled on all these other parts to central assessment to make other deals, and all of them
seemed to work out fine, except for this one part on the gigabit, which the bill had went through in about a month's time, and it was really fast. Everybody's desire was, let's get something that we can't get because it's so expensive, and let's give them a tax incentive to do it. So the main goal was, let's bring Google Fiber here. As Mark said, Google's not coming. But we also didn't want to be discriminatory. If existing companies could do that same kind of thing, we wanted to give them an incentive. But that's where it all fell apart, because we didn't write it very clearly. The Google type would be very expensive. For the other, it's not as expensive if you could build on existing. And we just have not been able to figure it out. In 2017, the speaker required a work group. We all worked on it for, you know, months and months to try to come to an agreement of how to make it work. And we really couldn't figure out a way to write an incentive that actually provided what we wanted, which was to incentivize something that wouldn't be done otherwise. And that's, again, our point at the league is, if you're going to do an exemption, it has to have a return on investment. And this has not shown that it is going to do something that wouldn't a company wouldn't do otherwise. And the ramifications of this is that exemption is worth so much money. I just want to reiterate what Mark just said, is that Frontier received this exemption this year. They spent $1.1 million in new investments. They got back $2.5 million in tax liability deduction. So they more than doubled. And that's going to keep happening unless we fix this. We do have a broadband problem in Oregon, that rural Oregon doesn't have broadband. And we were hoping this would help, but it isn't helping. There are other bills this session that will incentivize that behavior that we do want, or provide some funding at least for broadband. But this exemption did not work. It passed out of this committee, the repeal, 8-0 last in the 2018 session, and it did not make it across the line in the very last days of the session in the Senate. But this committee has already reviewed this issue before, so I just want to remind you of that. It's incredibly complex and costly for the Department of Revenue, the assessors, and the PUC to be involved in this issue, and just the players and the details of the process never worked either, let alone the policy that was and the technical words just didn't work. We spent months and months in the PUC hearings trying to get it to work narrowly, and that didn't work either. The bottom line is that this is an exemption that didn't work, and we all know how hard it is to pass a bill, but it's even harder to undo it, and that's kind of where we're at. And we've been working on it since it passed in 2015, and the league respectfully requests that you pass it on this time and take it off the books. Everybody's taking care of. Google's not here. Comcast has a settlement. Frontier has gotten it for a year. So a straight repeal now will stop the madness, and the return on investment just wasn't there for our taxpayers. I also just want to put on the record, thank Representative Nose for leading the work group and trying to come to a deal on this, we all concluded that the repeal was necessary, and the amount of time he's put into it, we just really thank him for that work. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, rather than taking questions from this panel, it's we will be carrying over the conversation to Monday, and before we end today, I'd like to hear from at least one or two other people, if that's all right, and then we can have opportunity for questions and discussion again Monday. And these two individuals I know are in the building all the time. Yes.
And I would say, Madam Chair, I was very tempted to read Representative Nose's testimony for him, because I'm sure that it will be, I had brief as well, but I'm happier to wait and testify with him on Monday. So
thank you. Thank you both. I'd like to hear now from Jessica Epley and Brant Wolf.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jessica Epley, representing Frontier Communications. I have lots of prepared comments, but I think I want to react to some things that I heard first as the lone qualified applicant under this project. I heard Department of Revenue make reference that if you build it, you get the exemption. And I will tell you, Frontier's history with this exemption would not indicate that that was in fact the case. We were incentivized to do something we would not have otherwise done, which is what the League of Oregon Cities represented that the intent of this exemption was for. Frontier was not looking to build a symmetrical gigabit product in the state of Oregon. In fact, I will tell you that this is one of two places where we have this product as a direct result of this tax exemption. So if we could, and if the chair would indulge me a bit, I'd like to walk through a bit of the history of Frontier with this particular exemption. In 2015, when the legislation was originally discussed, Frontier wasn't even a part of that discussion. we sort of watched from afar in a bit of disbelief, and at the end of it came together and said, hey, somebody out there wants this. We put together a business plan, and before we even put money into dedicated accounts, we wanted that business plan to be reviewed to even see if the idea would be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. There was confidential information shared because they are a regulatory body overseeing us. We are able to share information with them in a way that made us feel comfortable with that negotiation. And after a very prolonged process, in March of 2016, Frontier was granted the exemption status, granted that qualified project status. Here we are, 2019. We've been putting money into this product. We've been offering it since 2016. I have yet to get more than a few months of a tax exemption. Department of Revenue has declined to give it to us repeatedly, stating that it didn't meet what they thought was the criteria under the statute, but yet it was certified by the Public Utilities Commission. We paid the $50,000 application fee. We've gone through that vetting process. We have taken that money. The first year, more than $2.6 million were spent specific to this product. That was reported to the legislature. The second year, we've spent another, in the second year of the report, another $1.1 million. So Frontier has not been made whole. This was a case of, if you build it, they will come. At least that was the promise from the legislature. We built it. The question of whether or not people showed up or not was not the case. Now, that said, we do have customers. We have both business and residential customers on this product today. And those customers are going to need some time to transition. While I understand that the public policy intent of getting Google Fiber to come to Oregon did not occur, in this case, Frontier did step up and fill that need. And we just want to be made whole. So we would ask that there be an amendment offered somewhere allowing around until 1/1/2020 for Frontier so that we can transition these customers off and continue to have that exemption while we're continuing to offer that product. If you want to remove it for all new applicants, we understand that position. We support it. But please don't cut it off before we've been made whole.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Mr.
Okay. And, oh, we're really close to the end of time. I'd like to hear from Mr. Wolf, if that's all right.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. Frontier is a member of ours. You have heard from me ad nauseum on this matter over the years, so I'll be brief. We are here to support our member Frontier Communications on this issue. Our position has never changed. Tax credits passed, fee is paid, project submitted, project is approved, tax credit is due, and the meter is running until that changes. I could go into all kinds of detail, but I think of this in very simple, straightforward terms, and we're here to support Frontier Communications on this matter, including the amendment that they asked for, which we think is reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you stay for one or two more minutes while Representative Smith-Warner asks a question? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues. Thank you both for being here. I know that you met with my staff, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to make that. I've gotten briefed on that. I want to clarify, though, something that I think you just said, and so did you say that Frontier spent like $2 million on building this? You have gotten that much in the tax credit, and now if the tax credit goes away, you are going to disassemble the project and stop offering the service? So you spend the money on it, you get the tax credit that pays for that, and then when the tax credit goes away, you stop offering the service, even though one would assume that now that you have the service and you have customers, those customers are paying you for the service?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith-Warner, Frontier is going to need to make sense of how this network is going to continue to operate. In offering this very expensive product, it costs a lot of money for us to operate the network. There have been investments made to get it up and running, but as we have customers that are continuing to demand more and more of us, we're reaching capacity for even those investments. And so at the point that the tax exemption goes away, Frontier would intend to take those customers and move them on to a lower speed product that we can use our existing infrastructure without having to put this additional strain on there. That tax credit made this possible. Once it's gone, that's not something that we can continue to operate without redesigning our network. So we're going to take a step back and really look at how we could do that most effectively.
Thank you. This continues, and this is another, to go back to Rep. Smith's point from earlier, clearly I do not do telecommunications, I'm not a fiber person, but I continue to be mystified that the investment that you would, that it wouldn't pay for itself, that once you had the paying for the investment, the idea that it wouldn't then, that it would just go away, that you would take it out of commission and not, even though you had paying customers for it? Because I would assume you did your pricing so that the payment of the customers, given that the investment was covered by the tax incentive, I would assume you would structure it so that you would make some money off of what you were charging the customers for the service. So I still don't understand, and what happens to that investment? Do you pull out that fiber? Does that, and again, I don't want to keep us here too long, and this feels like maybe we can have some offline, maybe we could draw me some charts. But right now, I that doesn't make any sense to me. So. And maybe we can continue this conversation on Monday, too.
We will. Thank you, everyone, for staying a few minutes late. Anyone who has signed up to testify and hasn't yet, I hope you're available for when we continue this. I'm carrying this over until Monday. No other business for today. Meeting is adjourned.